So you believe it would be wise, the doctor asks, to send him up to Disturbed? I believe it would at the very least be safe, the guy with the pipe answers, closing his eyes. I'm afraid I'll have to withdraw my suggestion and go along with Robert, Alvin tells them all, if only for my own protection. They all laugh. They're all more relaxed now, certain they've come round to the plan she was wanting. They all have a sip of coffee on it except the guy with the pipe, and he has a big to-do with the thing, going out all the time, goes through a lot of matches and sucking and puffing and popping of his lips. It finally smokes up again to suit him, and he says a little proudly, "Yes, Disturbed ward for old Red McMurphy, I'm afraid. You know what I think, observing him these few days?" "Schizophrenic reaction?" Alvin asks. Pipe shakes his head. "Latent homosexual with reaction formation?" the third one says. Pipe shakes his head again and shuts his eyes. "No," he says and smiles round the room. "Negative Oedipal." They all congratulate him. "Yes, I think there is a lot pointing to it," he says. "But whatever the final diagnosis is, we must keep one thing in mind. We're not dealing with an ordinary man." "You are very, very wrong, Mr. Gideon." It's the big nurse. Everybody's head jerks toward her. Mine too, but I check myself and pass the motion off like I'm trying to scrub a speck I just discovered on the wall above my head. Everybody's confused all to hell for sure now. They figured they were proposing just what she'd want, just what she was planning to propose in the meeting herself. I thought so too. I've seen her send men half the size of McMurphy up to Disturbed for no more reason than there was a chance they might spit on somebody. Now she's got this bull of a man who's bucked her and everybody else on the staff, a guy she all but said was on his way off the ward earlier this afternoon, and she says no. "No, I don't agree. Not at all." She smiles around at all of them. "I don't agree that he should be sent up to Disturbed, which would simply be an easy way of passing our problem on to another ward, and I don't agree that he is some kind of extraordinary being. Some kind of super psychopath." She waits, but nobody is about to disagree. For the first time, she takes a sip of her coffee. The cup comes away from her mouth with that red-orange color on it. I stare at the rim of the cup in spite of myself. She couldn't be wearing lipstick that color. The color on the rim of the cup must be from heat. Touch of her lips set it smoldering. "I'll admit that my first thought when I began to recognize Mr. McMurphy for the disturbing force that he is was that he should most definitely be sent up to Disturbed. But now I believe it is too late. Would removing him undo the harm that he has done to our ward?" "I don't believe it would. Not after this afternoon. I believe if he were sent to Disturbed now, it would be exactly what the patients would expect. He would be a martyr to them. They would never be given the opportunity to see that this man is not an, as you put it, Mr. Gideon, extraordinary person." She takes another sip and sets the cup on the table. The whack of it sounds like a gavel. All three residents sit bold upright. "No, he isn't extraordinary. He is simply a man and no more, and is subject to all the fears and all the cowardice and all the timidity that any other man is subject to. Given a few more days, I have a very strong feeling that he will prove this to us as well as the rest of the patients. If we keep him on the ward, I am certain his brashness will subside, his self-made rebellion will dwindle to nothing, and..." She smiles, knowing something nobody else does. "That our red-headed hero will cut himself down to something the patients will all recognize and lose respect for, a braggart and a blowhard of the type who may climb up on a soapbox and shout for a following the way we've all seen Mr. Cheswick do, then back down the moment there is any real danger to him personally." "Patient McMurphy..." The boy with the pipe feels he should try to defend his position and save face just a little bit. "Does not strike me as a coward." I expect her to get mad, but she doesn't. She just gives him that let's wait and see look and says, "I didn't say he was exactly a coward, Mr. Gideon. Oh, no. He's simply very fond of someone. As a psychopath, he's much too fond of a Mr. Randall Patrick McMurphy to subject him to any needless danger. She gives the boy a smile that puts his pipe out for sure this time. If we just wait for a while, our hero will... What is it you college boys say? Give up his bit? Yes? But that may take weeks, the boy starts. We have weeks, she says. She stands up, looking more pleased with herself than I've seen her look since McMurphy came to trouble her a week ago. We have weeks or months or even years if need be. Keep in mind that Mr. McMurphy is committed. The length of time he spends in this hospital is entirely up to us. Now, if there is nothing else... The way the big nurse acted so confident in that staff meeting, that worried me for a while. But it didn't make any difference to McMurphy. All weekend and the next week, he was just as hard on her and her black boys as he ever was, and the patients were loving it. He'd won his bet. He'd got the nurse's goat the way he said he would, and had collected on it. But that didn't stop him from going right ahead and acting like he always had, hollering up and down the hall, laughing at the black boys, frustrating the whole staff, even going so far as to step up to the big nurse in the hall one time and ask her, if she didn't mind telling, just what was the actual inch-by-inch measurement on them great big old breasts that she did her best to conceal but never could. She walked right on past, ignoring him just like she chose to ignore the way nature had tagged her with those outsized badges of femininity, just like she was above him and sex and everything else that's weak and of the flesh. When she posted work assignments on the bulletin board, and he read that she'd given him latrine duty, he went to her office and knocked on that window of hers and personally thanked her for the honor, and told her he'd think of her every time he swabbed out a urinal. She told him that wasn't necessary, just do his work and that would be sufficient, thank you. The most work he did on them was to run a brush around the bowls once or twice apiece, singing some song as loud as he could in time to the swishing brush. Then he'd splash in some Clorox and he'd be through. "That's clean enough," he'd tell the black boy who got after him for the way he hurried through his job. "Maybe not clean enough for some people, but myself, I plan to piss in them, not eat lunch out of them." And when the big nurse gave in to the black boy's frustrated pleading and came in to check McMurphy's cleaning assignment personally, she brought a little compact mirror and she held it under the rim of the bowls. She walked along shaking her head and saying, "Why, this is an outrage," at every bowl. McMurphy sidled right along beside her, winking down his nose and saying in answer, "No, that's a toilet bowl. A toilet bowl." But she didn't lose control again, or even act at all like she might. She would get after him about the toilets, using that same terrible, slow, patient pressure she used on everybody, as he stood there in front of her, looking like a little kid getting a bawling out, hanging his head and the toe of one boot on top of the other, saying, "I try and try, ma'am, but I'm afraid I'll never make my mark as head man of the crappers." Once he wrote something on a slip of paper, strange writing that looked like a foreign alphabet, and stuck it up under one of those toilet bowl rims with a wad of gum. And when she came to that toilet with her mirror, she gave a short gasp at what she read reflected and dropped her mirror in the toilet. But she didn't lose control. That doll's face and that doll's smile were forged in confidence. She stood up from the toilet bowl and gave him a look that would peel paint and told him it was his job to make the latrine cleaner, not dirtier. Actually, there wasn't much cleaning of any kind getting done on the ward. As soon as it came time in the afternoon when the schedule called for house duties, it was also time for the baseball games to be on TV, and everybody went and lined the chairs up in front of the set, and they didn't move out of them until dinner. It didn't make any difference that the power was shut off in the nurse's station, and we couldn't see a thing but that blank gray screen, because McMurphy had entertained us for hours, sit and talk and tell all kinds of stories, like how he made $1,000 in 1 month driving truck for a gypo outfit and then lost every penny of it to some Canadian in an axe-throwing contest, or how he and a buddy slick-tonged a guy into riding a Brahma bull at a rodeo in Albany, into riding him while he wore a blindfold. Not the bull, I mean, the guy had on the blindfold. They told the guy that the blindfold would keep him from getting dizzy when the bull went to spinning. Then, when they got a bandana wrapped around his eyes to where he couldn't see, they set him on that bull backward. McMurphy told it a couple of times and slapped his thigh with his hat and laughed every time he remembered it. Blindfolded and backwards, and I'm a son of a gun if he didn't stay the limit and won the purse. And I was second. If he'd have been thrown, I'd have took first and a neat little purse. I swear the next time I pull a stunt like that, I'll blindfold the damn bull instead. Whack his leg and throw back his head and laugh, digging his thumb into the ribs of whoever was sitting next to him, trying to get him to laugh too. There was times that week when I'd hear that full-throttled laugh, watch him scratching his belly and stretching and yawning and leaning back to wink at whoever he was joking with, everything coming to him just as natural as drawing breath, and I'd quit worrying about the big nurse and the combine behind her. I think he was strong enough being his own self that he would never back down the way she was hoping he would. I think maybe he truly is something extraordinary. He's what he is, that's it. Maybe that makes him strong enough being what he is. The combine hasn't got to him in all these years. What makes that nurse think she's going to be able to do it in a few weeks? He's not going to let them twist him and manufacture him. And later, hiding in the latrine from the black boys, I'd take a look at my own self in the mirror and wonder how it was possible that anybody could manage such an enormous thing as being what he was. There'd be my face in the mirror. Dark and hard with big high cheekbones, like the cheek underneath them had been hacked out with a hatchet. Eyes all black and hard and mean-looking, just like Papa's eyes, or the eyes of all those tough, mean-looking Indians you see on TV. And I'd think, that ain't me. That ain't my face. It wasn't even me when I was trying to be that face. I wasn't even really me then. I was just being the way I looked. The way people wanted. It don't seem like I ever have been me. How can McMurphy be what he is? I was seeing him different than when he first came in. I was seeing more to him than just big hands and red sideburns and a broken-nosed grin. I'd see him do things that didn't fit with his face or hands. Things like painting a picture at OT with real paints on a blank paper with no lines or numbers anywhere on it to tell him where to paint. Or like writing letters to somebody in a beautiful flowing hand. How could a man who looked like him paint pictures or write letters to people or be upset and worried like I saw him once when he got a letter back? These were the kinds of things you expected from Billy Bibbit or Harding. Harding had hands that looked like they should have done paintings, though they never did. Harding trapped his hands and forced them to work sawing planks for doghouses. McMurphy wasn't like that. He hadn't let what he'd looked like run his life one way or the other any more than he'd let the combine mill him into fitting where they wanted him to fit. I was seeing lots of things different. I figured the fog machine had broke down in the walls when they turned it up too high for that meeting on Friday, so now they weren't able to circulate fog and gas and follow up the way things looked. For the first time in years, I was seeing people with none of that black outline they used to have. And one night, I was even able to see out the windows. Like I explained, most nights before they ran me to bed, they gave me this pill, knocked me out, and kept me out. Or if something went haywire with a dose and I woke up, my eyes were all crusted over and the dorm was full of smoke, wires in the walls loaded to the limit, twisting and sparking death and hate in the air. All too much for me to take, so I'd ram my head under the pillow and try to get back to sleep. Every time I peeked back out, there would be the smell of burning hair and a sound like side meat on a hot griddle. But this one night, a few nights after the big meeting, I woke up and the dorm was clean and silent, except for the soft breathing of the men and the stuff rattling around loose under the brittle ribs of the two old vegetables. It was dead quiet. A window was up. And the air in the dorm was clear and had a taste to it. Made me feel kind of giddy and drunk. Gave me this sudden yen to get up out of bed and do something. I slid from between the sheets and walked barefoot across the cold tile between the beds. I felt the tile with my feet and wondered how many thousand times had I run a mop over the same tile floor and never felt it at all. That mopping seemed like a dream to me, like I couldn't exactly believe all those years of it had really happened. Only that cold linoleum under my feet was real right then. Only that moment. I walked among the guys heaped in long white rows like snowbanks, careful not to bump into somebody, till I came to the wall with the windows. I walked down the windows to one where the shade popped softly in and out with the breeze, and I pressed my forehead up against the mesh. The wire was cold and sharp, and I rolled my head against it from side to side to feel it with my cheeks, and I smelled the breeze. It's fall coming, I thought. I can smell that sour molasses smell of silage clanging the air like a bell, smell somebody's been burning oak leaves, left them to smolder overnight because they're too green. It's fall coming, I kept thinking. Fall coming. Just like that was the strangest thing ever happened. Fall. Right outside here it was spring a while back, then it was summer, and now it's fall. That's sure a curious idea. I realized I still had my eyes shut. I had shut them when I put my face to the screen like I was scared to look outside. Now I had to open them. I looked out the window and saw for the first time how the hospital was out in the country. The moon was low in the sky over the pasture land. The face of it was scarred and scuffed where it had just torn up out of the snarl of scrub oak and madrona trees on the horizon. The stars up close to the moon were pale. They got brighter and braver the farther they got out of that circle of light ruled by the giant moon. It called to mind how I noticed the exact same thing when I was off on a hunt with Papa and the uncles, and I lay rolled in blankets Grandma had woven, lying off a piece from where the men hunkered around the fire as they passed a quart jar of cactus liquor in a silent circle. I watched that big Oregon prairie moon above me put all the stars around it to shame. I kept awake watching, to see if the moon ever got dimmer, or if the stars got brighter, till the dew commenced to drift onto my cheeks, and I had to pull a blanket over my head. Something moved on the grounds beneath my window, cast a long spider of shadow out across the grass as it ran out of sight behind a hedge. When it ran back to where I could get a better look, I saw it was a dog. A young gangly mongrel slipped off from home to find out about things went on after dark. He was sniffing digger squirrel holes, not with a notion to go digging after one, but just to get an idea what they were up to at this hour. He'd run his muzzle down a hole, butt up in the air and tail going, then dash off to another. The moon glistened around him on the wet grass, and when he ran he left tracks like dabs of dark paint spattered across the blue shine of the lawn. Galloping from one particularly interesting hole to the next, he became so took with what was coming off, the moon up there, the night, the breeze full of smell so wild makes a young dog drunk, that he had to lie down on his back and roll. He twisted and thrashed around like a fish, back bowed and belly up, and when he got up to his feet and shook himself, a spray came off him in the moon like silver scales. He sniffed all the holes over again, one quick one, to get the smells down good, then suddenly froze still with one paw lifted and his head tilted, listening. I listened too, but I couldn't hear anything except the popping of the window shade. I listened for a long time. Then, from a long way off, I heard a high, laughing gabble, faint and coming closer. Canada honkers going south for the winter. I remembered all the hunting and belly crawling I'd ever done trying to kill a honker, and that I never got one. I tried to look where the dog was looking to see if I could find the flock, but it was too dark. The honking came closer and closer till it seemed like they must be flying right through the dorm, right over my head. Then they crossed the moon, a black weaving necklace drawn into a V by that lead goose. For an instant that lead goose was right in the center of that circle, bigger than the others, a black cross opening and closing. Then he pulled his V out of sight into the sky once more. I listened to them fade away, till all I could hear was my memory of the sound. The dog could still hear them for a long time after me. He was still standing with his paw up. He hadn't moved or barked when they flew over. When he couldn't hear them anymore either, he commenced to lope off in the direction they had gone, toward the highway, loping steady and solemn like he had an appointment. I held my breath, and I could hear the flap of his big paws on the grass as he loped. Then I could hear a car speed up out of a turn. The headlights loomed over the rise and peered ahead down the highway. I watched the dog and the car making for the same spot of pavement. The dog was almost to the rail fence at the edge of the grounds when I felt somebody slip up behind me. Two people. I didn't turn, but I knew it was the black boy named Giver and the nurse with the birthmark and the crucifix. I heard a whir of fear start up in my head. The black boy took my arm and pulled me around.
"I'll get him," he says.
"It's chilly at the window there, Mr. Bromden," the nurse tells me. "Don't you think we'd better climb back into our nice toasty bed?"
"He can't hear," the black boy tells her. "I'll take him. He always untying his sheet and roaming round."
And I move, and she draws back a step and says,
"Yes, please do,"
to the black boy. She's fiddling with the chain runs down her neck. At home, she locks herself in the bathroom out of sight, strips down and rubs that crucifix all over that stain running from the corner of her mouth in a thin line down across her shoulders and breasts. She rubs and rubs and hails Mary to beat thunder, but the stain stays. She looks in the mirror, sees it's darker than ever. Finally takes a wire brush used to take paint off boats and scrubs the stain away. Puts a nightgown on over the raw, oozing hide and crawls into bed. But she's too full of the stuff. While she's asleep, it rises in her throat and into her mouth and drains out of that corner of her mouth like purple spit and down her throat over her body. In the morning, she sees how she's stained again and somehow figures it's not really from inside her. How could it be, a good Catholic girl like her? And she figures it's on account of working evenings among a whole ward full of people like me. It's all our fault, and she's going to get us for it if it's the last thing she does. I wish McMurphy would wake up and help me.
"You get him tied in bed, Mr. Giver, and I'll prepare medication."
In the group meetings, there were gripes coming up that had been buried so long the thing being griped about had already changed. Now that McMurphy was around to back them up, the guys started letting fly at everything that had ever happened on the ward they didn't like.
"Why does the dorms have to be locked on the weekends?"
Cheswick or somebody would ask.
"Can a fellow even have the weekends to himself?"
"Yeah, Miss Ratchet," McMurphy would say.
"Why?"
"If the dorms were left open, we have learned from past experience, you men would return to bed after breakfast."
"Is that a mortal sin? I mean, normal people get to sleep late on the weekends."
"You men are in this hospital," she would say like she was repeating it for the 100th time, "because of your proven inability to adjust to society. The doctor and I believe that every minute spent in the company of others, with some exceptions, is therapeutic, while every minute spent brooding alone only increases your separation."
"Is that the reason that there has to be at least 8 guys together before they can be taken off the ward to OT or PT or one of them T's?"
"That is correct."
"You mean it's sick to want to be off by yourself?"
"I didn't say that."
"You mean if I go into latrine to relieve myself, I should take along at least 7 buddies to keep me from brooding on the can?"
Before she could come up with an answer to that, Cheswick bounced to his feet and hollered at her.
"Yeah, is that what you mean?"
And the other acute sitting around the meeting would say, "Yeah, yeah, is that what you mean?" She would wait till they all died down and the meeting was quiet again, then say quietly, "If you men can calm yourself enough to act like a group of adults at a discussion instead of children on the playground, we will ask the doctor if he thinks it would be beneficial to consider a change in the ward policy at this time." "Doctor?" Everybody knew the kind of answer the doctor would make, and before he even had the chance, Cheswick would be off on another complaint.
"Then what about our cigarettes, Miss Ratchet?"
"Yeah, what about that?"
the acute grumbled. McMurphy turned to the doctor and put the question straight to him this time before the nurse had a chance to answer.
"Yeah, Doc, what about our cigarettes? How does she have the right to keep the cigarettes, our cigarettes, piled up on her desk in there like she owned them, bleed out a pack to us now and again whenever she feels like it?
I don't care much about the idea of buying a carton of cigarettes and having somebody tell me when I can smoke them.
The doctor tilted his head so he could look at the nurse through his glasses. He hadn't heard about her taking over the extra cigarettes to stop the gambling.
What's this about cigarettes, Miss Ratchet? I don't believe I've heard...
I feel, Doctor, that 3 and 4 and sometimes 5 packages of cigarettes a day are entirely too many for a man to smoke. That is what seemed to be happening last week after Mr. McMurphy's arrival, and that is why I thought it might be best to impound the cartons the men purchased at the canteen and allow each man only 1 pack a day. McMurphy leaned forward and whispered loudly to Cheswick,
"Here, tell her next decision is about trips to the can. Not only does a guy have to take his 7 buddies into the latrine with him, but he's also limited to 2 trips a day to be taken when she says so."
And leaned back in his chair and laughed so hard that nobody else could say anything for nearly a minute. McMurphy was getting a lot of kick out of all the ruckus he was raising, and I think was a little surprised that he wasn't getting a lot of pressure from the staff, too, especially surprised that the big nurse wasn't having any more to say to him than she was.
"I thought the old buzzard was tougher than this," he said to Harding after one meeting. "Maybe all she needed to straighten her out was a good bring-down. The thing is," he frowned, "she acts like she still holds all the cards up that white sleeve of hers."
He went on getting a kick out of it till about Wednesday of the next week. Then he learned why the big nurse was so sure of her hand. Wednesday's the day they pack everybody up who hasn't got some kind of rot and move to the swimming pool, whether we want to go or not. When the fog was on the ward, I used to hide in it to get out of going. The pool always scared me. I was always afraid I'd step in over my head and drown, be sucked off down the drain and clean out to sea. I used to be real brave around water when I was a kid on the Columbia. I'd walk the scaffolding around the falls with all the other men, scrambling around with water roaring green and white all around me and the mist making rainbows, without even any hobnails like the men wore. But when I saw my papa start getting scared of things, I got scared too. Got so I couldn't even stand a shallow pool. We came out of the locker room, and the pool was pitching and splashing and full of naked men. Whooping and yelling bounced off the high ceiling the way it always does in indoor swimming pools. The black boys herded us into it. The water was a nice warm temperature, but I didn't want to get away from the side. The black boys walk along the edge with long bamboo poles to shove you away from the side if you try to grab on. So I stayed close to McMurphy, on account of I knew they wouldn't try to make him go into deep water if he didn't want to. He was talking to the lifeguard, and I was standing a few feet away. McMurphy must have been standing in a hole, because he was having to tread water where I was just standing on the bottom. The lifeguard was standing on the edge of the pool. He had a whistle and a t-shirt on with his ward number on it. He and McMurphy had got to talking about the difference between hospital and jail, and McMurphy was saying how much better the hospital was. The lifeguard wasn't so sure. I heard him tell McMurphy that, for one thing, being committed ain't like being sentenced.
"You're sentenced in a jail, and you got a date ahead of you when you know you're going to be turned loose," he said.
McMurphy stopped splashing around like he had been. He swam slowly to the edge of the pool and held there, looking up at the lifeguard.
"And if you're committed?"
he asked after a pause. The lifeguard raised his shoulders in a muscle-bound shrug and tugged at the whistle around his neck. He was an old pro footballer with cleat marks in his forehead. And every so often when he was off his ward, a signal would click back of his eyes, and his lips would go to spitting numbers, and he'd drop to all fours in a line stance and cut loose on some strolling nurse, drive a shoulder in her kidneys just in time to let the halfback shoot past through the hole behind him. That's why he was up undisturbed. Whenever he wasn't lifeguarding, he was liable to do something like that. He shrugged again at McMurphy's question, then looked back and forth to see if any black boys were around, and knelt close to the edge of the pool. He held out his arm for McMurphy to look at.
"You see this cast?"
McMurphy looked at the big arm.
"You don't have a cast on that arm, buddy."
The lifeguard just grinned.
"Well, that cast's on there because I got a bad fracture in the last game with the Browns. I can't get back in togs till the fracture knits and I get the cast off. The nurse on my ward tells me she's curing the arm in secret. Yeah, man, she says if I go easy on that arm, don't exert it or nothing, she'll take the cast off and I can get back with the ball club."
He put his knuckles on the wet tile, went into a 3-point stance to test how the arm was coming along. McMurphy watched him a minute,
then asked how long he'd been waiting for them to tell him his arm was healed so he could leave the hospital. The lifeguard raised up slowly and rubbed his arm. He acted hurt that McMurphy had asked that, like he thought he was being accused of being soft and licking his wounds.
"I'm committed," he said. "I'd have left here before now if it was up to me. Maybe I couldn't play first string with this bum arm, but I could have folded towels, couldn't I? I could have done something. That nurse in my ward, she keeps telling the doctor I ain't ready. Not even to fold towels in the crummy old locker room, I ain't ready."
He turned and walked over to his lifeguard chair, climbed up the chair ladder like a drugged gorilla, and peered down at us, his lower lip pushed way out.
"I was picked up for drunk and disorderly, and I've been here 8 years and 8 months, he said.
McMurphy pushed backward from the edge of the pool and trod water and thought this over. He'd had a 6-month sentence at the work farm with 2 months finished, 4 more to go, and 4 more months was the most he wanted to spend locked up any place. He'd been close to a month in this nut house, and it might be a lot better than a work farm, what with good beds and orange juice for breakfast, but it wasn't better to the point that he'd want to spend a couple of years here. He swam over to the steps at the shallow end of the pool and sat there the rest of the period, tugging that little tuft of wool at his throat and frowning. Watching him sitting there frowning all to himself, I remembered what the big nurse had said in the meeting, and I began to feel afraid. When they blew the whistle for us to leave the pool and we were all straggling toward the locker room, we ran into this other ward coming into the swimming pool for their period, and in the foot bath at the shower you had to go through was this one kid from the other ward. He had a big spongy pink head and bulgy hips and legs, like somebody'd grabbed a balloon full of water and squeezed it in the middle. And he was lying on his side in the foot bath, making noises like a sleepy seal. Cheswick and Harding helped him stand up, and he lay right back down in the foot bath. The head bobbed around in the disinfectant. McMurphy watched them lift him standing again.
"What the devil is he?" he asked.
"He has hydrocephalus," Harding told him. "Some manner of lymph disorder, I believe. Head fills up with liquid. Give us a hand helping him stand up." They turned the kid loose, and he lay back down in the footbath again. The look on his face was patient and helpless and stubborn. His mouth sputtered and blew bubbles in the milky-looking water. Harding repeated his request to McMurphy to give them a hand, and he and Cheswick bent down to the kid again. McMurphy pushed past them and stepped across the kid into the shower.
"Let him lay," he said, washing himself down in the shower. "Maybe he don't like deep water."
I could see it coming. The next day he surprised everybody on the ward by getting up early and polishing that latrine till it sparkled, and then went to work on the hall floors when the black boys asked him to. Surprised everybody but the big nurse. She acted like it was nothing surprising at all. And that afternoon in the meeting when Cheswick said that everybody'd agreed that there should be some kind of showdown on the cigarette situation, saying,
"I ain't no little kid to have cigarettes kept from me like cookies. We want something done about it, ain't that right, Mac?"
and waited for McMurphy to back him up. All he got was silence. He looked over at McMurphy's corner. Everybody did. McMurphy was there, studying the deck of cards that slid in and out of sight in his hands. He didn't even look up. It was awfully quiet. There was just that slap of greasy cards and Cheswick's heavy breathing.
"I want something done,"
Cheswick suddenly yelled again.
"I ain't no little kid."
He stamped his foot and looked around him like he was lost and might break out crying any minute. He clenched both fists and held them at his chubby round chest. His fists made little pink balls against the green, and they were clenched so hard he was shaking. He never had looked big. He was short and too fat and had a bald spot on the back of his head that showed like a pink dollar. But standing there by himself in the center of the day room like that, he looked tiny. He looked at McMurphy and got no look back, and went down the line of acutes looking for help. Each time a man looked away and refused to back him up, and the panic on his face doubled. His looking finally came to a stop at the big nurse. He stamped his foot again.
"I want something done! Hear me? I want something done! Something! Something! Some!"
The two big black boys clamped his arms from behind, and the least one threw a strap around him. He sagged like he'd been punctured, and the two big ones dragged him up to Disturbed. You could hear the soggy bounce of him going up the steps. When they came back and sat down, the big nurse turned to the line of acutes across the room and looked at them. Nothing had been said since Cheswick left.
"Is there any more discussion," she said, "on the rationing of cigarettes?"
Looking down the canceled row of faces hanging against the wall across the room from me, my eyes finally came to McMurphy in his chair in the corner, concentrating on improving his one-handed card cut, and the white tubes in the ceiling began to pump their refrigerated light again. I can feel it. Beams all the way into my stomach. After McMurphy doesn't stand up for us any longer, some of the acutes talk and say he's still outsmarting the big nurse, say that he got word that she was about to send him to Disturbed and decided to toe the line a while, not give her any reason. Others figure he's letting her relax, then he's going to spring something new on her, something wilder and more ornery than ever. You can hear them talking in groups, wondering. But me? I know why. I heard him talk to the lifeguard. He's finally getting cagey is all. The way Papa finally did when he came to realize that he couldn't beat that group from town who wanted the government to put in the dam because of the money and the work it would bring and because it would get rid of the village. Let that tribe of fish engines take their stink and their $200,000 the government is paying them and go someplace else with it. Papa had done the smart thing signing the papers. There wasn't anything to gain by bucking it. The government would have got it anyhow sooner or later. This way the tribe would get paid good. It was the smart thing. McMurphy was doing the smart thing. I could see that. He was giving in because it was the smartest thing to do, not because of any of these other reasons the acutes were making up. He didn't say so, but I knew, and I told myself it was the smart thing to do. I told myself that over and over. It's safe, like hiding. It's the smart thing to do. Nobody could say any different. I know what he's doing. Then one morning all the acutes know too, know his real reason for backing down, and that the reasons they have been making up were just lies to kid themselves. He never says a thing about the talk he had with the lifeguard, but they know. I figure the nurse broadcast this during the night along all the little lines in the dorm floor, because they all know at once. I can tell by the way they look at McMurphy that morning when he comes into the day room. Not looking like they're mad with him or even disappointed, because they can understand as well as I can that the only way he's going to get the big nurse to lift his commitment is by acting like she wants, but still looking at him like they wish things didn't have to be this way. Even Cheswick could understand it and didn't hold anything against McMurphy for not going ahead and making a big fuss over the cigarettes. He came back down from Disturbed on the same day that the nurse broadcast the information to the beds, and he told McMurphy himself that he could understand how he acted and that it was surely the sharpest thing to do, considering, and that if he'd thought about Mac being committed, he'd never have put him on the spot like he had the other day. He told McMurphy this while we were all being taken over to the swimming pool. But just as soon as we got to the pool, he said he did wish something might have been done, though, and dove into the water. And got his finger stuck some way in the grate that's over the drain at the bottom of the pool, and neither the big lifeguard, nor McMurphy, nor the two black boys could pry him loose. And by the time they got a screwdriver and undid the grate and brought Cheswick up, with the grate still clutched by his chubby pink and blue fingers, he was drowned. Up ahead of me in the lunch line I see a tray sling in the air. A green plastic cloud raining milk and peas and vegetable soup. Seafelt's jittering out of the line on one foot with his arms both up in the air, falls backward in a stiff arch, and the whites of his eyes come by me upside down. His head hits the tile with a crack like rocks under water, and he holds the arch like a twitching, jerking bridge. Fredrickson and Scanlon make a jump to help, but the big black boy shoves them back and grabs a flat stick out of his back pocket, got tape wrapped around it, and covered with a brown stain. He pries Seafelt's mouth open and shoves the stick between his teeth, and I hear the stick splinter with Seafelt's bite. I can taste the slivers. Seafelt's jerks slow down and get more powerful, working and building up to big stiff kicks that lift him to a bridge, then falling, lifting and falling, slower and slower, till the big nurse comes in and stands over him, and he melts limp all over the floor in a gray puddle. She folds her hands in front of her, might hold a candle, and looks down at what's left of him oozing out of the cuffs of his pants and shirt. "Mr. Seafelt?" she says to the black boy.
"That's right.
The black boy is jerking to get his stick back. Mr. Seafelt. And Mr. Seafelt has been asserting he needs no more medication. She nods her head, steps back a step out of the way of him spreading toward her white shoes. She raises her head and looks round her at the circle of acutes that have come up to see. She nods again and repeats, needs no more medication. Her face is smiling, pitying, patient, and disgusted all at once. A trained expression. McMurphy's never seen such a thing. What's he got wrong with him? He asks. She keeps her eye on the puddle, not turning to McMurphy. Mr. Seafelt is an epileptic, Mr. McMurphy. This means he may be subject to seizures like this at any time if he doesn't follow medical advice. He knows better. We told him this would happen when he didn't take his medication. Still, he will insist on acting foolish. Fredrickson comes out of the line with his eyebrows bristling. He's a sinewy, bloodless guy with blonde hair and stringy blonde eyebrows and a long jaw, and he acts tough every so often the way Cheswick used to try to do. Roar and rant and cuss out one of the nurses, say he's going to leave this stinking place. They always let him yell and shake his fist till he quiets down, then ask him if you are through, Mr. Fredrickson. We'll go start typing the release. Then make book in the nurse's station how long it'll be till he's tapping at the glass with a guilty look and asking to apologize, and how about just forgetting those hot-headed things he said. Just pigeonhole those old forms for a day or so, okay? He steps up to the nurse, shaking his fist at her. Oh, is that it? Is that it, huh? You're gonna crucify old Seif just as if he was doing it to spite you or something? She lays a comforting hand on his arm, and his fist unrolls. It's okay, Bruce. Your friend will be all right. Apparently he hasn't been swallowing his Dilantin. I simply don't know what he is doing with it. She knows as well as anybody. Seafelt holds the capsules in his mouth and gives them to Fredrickson later. Seafelt doesn't like to take them because of what he calls disastrous side effects, and Fredrickson likes a double dose because he's scared to death of having a fit. The nurse knows this. You can tell by her voice. But to look at her there, so sympathetic and kind, you'd think she was ignorant of anything at all between Fredrickson and Seafelt. Yeah, says Fredrickson, but he can't work his attack up again. Yeah, well, you don't need to act like it was as simple as just take the stuff or don't take it. You know how Seif worries about what he looks like and how women think he's ugly and all that, and you know how he thinks to die Lantern. I know, she says, and touches his arm again. He also blames his falling hair on the drug. Poor old fellow. He's not that old. I know, Bruce. Why do you get so upset? I've never understood what went on between you and your friend that made you get so defensive. Well, heck anyway, he says and jams his fists in his pockets. The nurse bends over and brushes the little place clean on the floor and puts her knee on it and starts kneading Seafelt back to some shape. She tells the black boy to stay with the poor old fellow, and she'll go send a gurney down for him, wheel him into the dorm, and let him sleep the rest of the day. When she stands, she gives Fredrickson a pat on the arm, and he grumbles, Yeah, I have to take Dilantin too, you know. That's why I know what Seif has to face. I mean, that's why I, well, heck. I understand, Bruce, what both of you must go through, but don't you think anything is better than that? Fredrickson looks where she points. Seafelt has pulled back halfway normal, swelling up and down with big, wet, rattling breaths. There's a punk knot rising on the side of his head where he landed, and a red foam around the black boy's stick where it goes into his mouth, and his eyes are beginning to roll back into the whites. His hands are nailed out to each side with the palms up, and the fingers jerking open and shut, just the way I've watched men jerk at the shock shop, strapped to the cross table. Smoke curling up out of the palms from the current. Seafelt and Fredrickson never been to the shock shop. They're manufactured to generate their own voltage, stored in their spines, and can be turned on remote from the steel door in the nurse's station if they get out of line. Be right in the best part of a dirty joke and stiffen like the jolt hits square in the small of the back. It saves the trouble of taking them over to that room. The nurse gives Fredrickson's arm a little shake like he'd gone to sleep and repeats, Even if you take into consideration the harmful effects of the medicine, don't you think it's better than that? As he stares down at the floor,
Fredrickson's blonde eyebrows are raised like he's seeing for the first time just how he looks at least once a month. The nurse smiles and pats his arm and heads for the door, glares at the acutes to shame them for gathering around watching such a thing. When she's gone, Fredrickson shivers and tries to smile.
I don't know what I got mad at the old girl about. I mean, she didn't do anything to give me a reason to blow up like that, did she?
It isn't like he wants an answer. It's more sort of realizing that he can't put his finger on a reason. He shivers again and starts to slip back away from the group. McMurphy comes up and asks him in a low voice, what is it they take?
Dilantin, McMurphy, an anticonvulsant if you must know.
Don't it work or something?
Yeah, I guess it works all right, if you take it.
Then what's the sweat about taking it or not?
Look, if you must know, here's the dirty sweat about taking it.
Fredrickson reaches up and grabs his lower lip between his thumb and finger, pulls it down to show gums ragged and pink and bloodless around long, shiny teeth.
Your gums, he says, hanging onto the lip. Dilantin makes your gums rot, and a seizure makes you grit your teeth and you...
There's a noise on the floor. They look to where Seafelt is moaning and wheezing, just as the black boy draws two teeth out with his taped stick. Scanlan takes his tray and walks away from the bunch, saying,
Hell of a life. Damned if you do and damned if you don't. Puts a man in one confounded bind, I say.
McMurphy says,
Yeah, I see what you mean,
looking down into Seafelt's gathering face. His face has commenced to take on that same haggard, puzzled look of pressure that the face on the floor has. Whatever it was went haywire in the mechanism, they've just about got it fixed again. The clean, calculated arcade movement is coming back. 6:30 out of bed, 7 into the mess hall, 8 the puzzles come out for the chronics and the cards for the acutes. In the nurse's station, I can see the white hands of the big nurse float over the controls. They take me with the acutes sometimes, and sometimes they don't. They take me once with them over to the library, and I walk over to the technical section, stand there looking at the titles of books on electronics, books I recognize from that year I went to college. I remember inside the books are full of schematic drawings and equations and theories. Hard, sure, safe things. I want to look at one of the books, but I'm scared to. I'm scared to do anything. I feel like I'm floating in the dusty yellow air of the library, halfway to the bottom, halfway to the top. The stacks of books teeter above me, crazy, zigzagging, running all different angles to one another. One shelf bends a little to the left, one to the right. Some of them are leaning over me, and I don't see how the books keep from falling out. It goes up and up this way, clear out of sight. The rickety stacks nailed together with slats and 2x4s, propped up with poles, leaning against ladders on all sides of me. If I pulled one book out, Lord knows what awful thing might result. I hear somebody walk in, and it's one of the black boys from our ward, and he's got Harding's wife with him. They're talking and grinning to each other as they come into the library.
See here, Dale,
the black boy calls over to Harding where he's reading a book.
Look here who come to visit you. I told her it wasn't visiting hours, but you know she just sweet-talked me into bringing her right on over here anyhow.
He leaves her standing in front of Harding and goes off, saying mysteriously, Don't you forget now, you hear? She blows the black boy a kiss, then turns to Harding, slinging her hips forward. Hello, Dale.
Honey,
he says, but he doesn't make any move to take the couple of steps to her. He looks around him at everybody watching. She's as tall as he is. She's got on high-heeled shoes and is carrying a black purse, not by the strap, but holding it the way you hold a book. Her fingernails are red as drops of blood against the shiny black patent leather purse.
Hey, Mac,
Harding calls to McMurphy, who's sitting across the room looking at a book of cartoons.
If you'll curtail your literary pursuits a moment, I'll introduce you to my counterpart and nemesis. I would be trite and say to my better half, but I think that phrase indicates some kind of basically equal division, don't you?
He tries to laugh, and his two slim ivory fingers dip into his shirt pocket for cigarettes, fidget around getting the last one from the package. The cigarette shakes as he places it between his lips. He and his wife haven't moved toward each other yet. McMurphy heaves up out of his chair and pulls his cap off as he walks over. Harding's wife looks at him and smiles, lifting one of her eyebrows.
Afternoon, Miss Harding,
McMurphy says. She smiles back bigger than before and says, I hate Mrs. Harding, Mac. Why don't you call me Vera? They all three sit back down on the couch where Harding was sitting, and he tells his wife about McMurphy and how McMurphy got the best of the big nurse, and she smiles and says that it doesn't surprise her a bit. While Harding's telling the story, he gets enthusiastic and forgets about his hands, and they weave the air in front of him into a picture clear enough to see, dancing the story to the tune of his voice, like two beautiful ballet women in white. His hands can be anything. But as soon as the story's finished, he notices McMurphy and his wife are watching the hands, and he traps them between his knees. He laughs about this, and his wife says to him, Dale, when are you going to learn to laugh instead of making that mousy little squeak? It's the same thing that McMurphy said about Harding's laugh on that first day, but it's different somehow. Where McMurphy saying it calmed Harding down, her saying it makes him more nervous than ever. She asks for a cigarette, and Harding dips his fingers in his pocket again, and it's empty. We've been rationed, he says, folding his thin shoulders forward like he was trying to hide the half-smoked cigarette he was holding, to one pack a day. That doesn't seem to leave a man any margin for chivalry, Vera, my dearest. Oh, Dale, you never do have enough, do you? His eyes take on that sly, fevered skittishness as he looks at her and smiles. Are we speaking symbolically, or are we still dealing with the concrete here-and-now cigarettes? No matter, you know the answer to the question, whichever way you intended it. I didn't intend nothing by it except what I said, Dale. You didn't intend anything by it, sweetest. Your use of didn't and nothing constitutes a double negative. McMurphy, Vera's English rivals yours for illiteracy. Look, honey, you understand that between no and any, there is... All right, that's enough. I meant it both ways. I meant it any way you want to take it. I meant you don't have enough of nothing, period. Enough of anything, my bright little child. She glares at Harding a second, then turns to McMurphy sitting beside her. You, Mac, what about you? Can you handle a simple little thing like offering a girl a cigarette? His package is already lying in his lap. He looks down at it like he wishes it wasn't, then says, Sure, I always got cigarettes. Reason is, I'm a bum. I bum them whenever I get the chance is why my pack lasts longer than Harding's here. He smokes only his own. So you can see he's more likely to run out than... You don't have to apologize for my inadequacies, my friend. It neither fits your character nor complements mine. No, it doesn't, the girl says. All you have to do is light my cigarette. And she leans so far forward to his match that even clear across the room I could see down her blouse. She talks some more about some of Harding's friends who she wishes would quit dropping around the house looking for him. You know the type, don't you, Mac? She says. The hoity-toity boys with the nice long hair combed so perfectly, and the limp little wrists that flip so nice. Harding asks her if it was only him that they were dropping around to see, and she says that any man that drops around to see her flips more than his damned limp wrists. She stands suddenly and says it's time for her to go. She takes McMurphy's hand and tells him she hopes she sees him again sometime, and she walks out of the library. McMurphy can't say a word. At the clack of her high heels, everybody's head comes up again, and they watch her walk down the hall till she turns out of sight. What do you think? Harding says. McMurphy starts. She's got one hell of a set of chababs, is all I can think of. Big as old Lady Ratchet's. I didn't mean physically, my friend. I mean, what do you... Hell's bells, Harding! McMurphy yells suddenly. I don't know what to think. What do you want out of me, a marriage counselor? All I know is this. Nobody's very big in the first place, and it looks to me like everybody spends their whole life tearing everybody else down. I know what you want me to think. You want me to feel sorry for you, to think she's a real bitch. Well, you didn't make her feel like any queen either. Well, screw you, and what do you think? I've got my own worries without getting hooked with yours, so just quit. He glares around the library at the other patients. All of you, quit bugging me, goddammit! And sticks his cap back on his head and walks back to his cartoon magazine across the room. All the acutes are looking at each other with their mouths open. What's he hollering at them about? Nobody's been bugging him. Nobody's asked him for a thing since they found out he was trying to behave to keep his commitment from being extended. Now they're surprised at the way he just blew up at Harding and can't figure the way he grabs the book up from the chair and sits down and holds it up close in front of his face, either to keep people from looking at him or to keep from having to look at people. That night at supper, he apologizes to Harding and says he don't know what hung him up so at the library. Harding says perhaps it was his wife. She frequently hangs people up. McMurphy sits staring into his coffee and says,
I don't know, man. I just met her this afternoon.
So she sure the hell isn't the one been giving me bad dreams this last miserable week.
Why, Mr. McMurphy!
Harding cries, trying to talk like the little resident boy who comes to the meetings.
You simply must tell us about these dreams. Ah, wait until I get my pencil and pad.
Harding is trying to be funny to relieve the strain of the apology. He picks up a napkin and a spoon and acts like he's going to take notes.
Now, precisely what was it you saw in these, dreams?
McMurphy don't crack a smile.
I don't know, man. Nothing but faces, I guess. Just faces.
The next morning, Martini is behind the control panel in the tub room, playing like he's a jet pilot. The poker game stops to grin at his act.
Ground air, ground air. Object sighted 40-1600 appears to be enemy missile. Proceed at once.
Spins a dial, shoves a lever forward, and leans with the bank of the ship. He cranks a needle to on full at the side of the panel, but no water comes out of the nozzle set around the square tile booth in front of him. They don't use hydrotherapy anymore, and nobody's turned the water on. Brand new chrome equipment and steel panel never been used. Except for the chrome, the panel and shower look just like the hydrotherapy outfits they used at the old hospital 15 years ago. Nozzles capable of reaching parts of the body from every angle. A technician in a rubber apron standing on the other side of the room manipulating the controls on that panel, dictating which nozzle squirt where, how hard, how hot. Spray opened soft and soothing, then squeezed sharp as a needle. You hung up there between the nozzles and canvas straps, soaked and limp and wrinkled while the technician enjoyed his toy.
Air to ground, air to ground, missile sighted. Coming into my sights now.
Martini bends down and aims over the panel through the ring of nozzles. He closes one eye and peeps through the ring with the other eye.
On target, ready? Aim! Fire!
His hands jerk back from the panel and he stands bolt upright, hair flying and both eyes bulging out at the shower booth so wild and scared, all the card players spin around in their chairs to see if they can see it too, but they don't see anything in there but the buckles. Hanging among the nozzles on stiff new canvas straps. Martini turns and looks straight at McMurphy, no one else.
Didn't you see them? Didn't you?
See who, Mart? I don't see anything.
And all those straps, didn't you?
McMurphy turns and squints at the shower.
Nope, not a thing. Hold on a minute, they need you to see them,
Martini says.
Damn you, Martini, I told you I can't see them, understand? Not a blessed thing.
Oh,
Martini says. He nods his head and turns from the shower booth.
Well, I didn't see them either. I was just kidding you.
McMurphy cuts the deck and shuffles it with a buzzing snap.
Well, I don't care for that sort of kidding, Mart.
He cuts to shuffle again, and the cards splash everywhere, like the deck exploded between his two trembling hands. I remember it was Friday again, 3 weeks after we voted on TV, and everybody who could walk was herded over to Building 1 for what they try to tell us is chest x-rays for TB, which I know is a check to see if everybody's machinery is functioning up to par. We're benched in a long row down a hall leading to a door marked x-ray. Next to x-ray is a door marked EENT, where they check our throats during the winter. Across the hall from us is another bench. And it leads to that metal door, with a line of rivets, and nothing marked on it at all. Two guys are dozing on the bench between two black boys, while another victim inside is getting his treatment, and I can hear him screaming. The door opens inward with a whoosh, and I can see the twinkling tubes in the room. They wheel the victim out, still smoking, and I grip the bench where I sit to keep from being sucked through that door. A black boy and a white one drag one of the other guys on the bench to his feet, and he sways and staggers under the drugs in him. They usually give you red capsules before shock.
They push him through the door,
and the technicians get him under each arm. For a second, I see the guy realizes where they got him, and he stiffens both heels into the cement floor to keep from being pulled to the table. Then the door pulls shut, thump, with metal hitting a mattress, and I can't see him anymore.
Man, what they got going on in there?
McMurphy asks Harding.
In there?
Why, that's right, isn't it? You haven't had the